share the topics that drive the discussions of your favorite talk shows with TalkStream Live's topic-driven talk radio.
We gotta talk. Take a drive.
List and promote real-time talk radio topics, or post the topics that you want to hear. Hot topics are tweeted and retweeted, and include simple click-to-listen audio links. The future of talk radio is topic-driven talk radio.
Now that's what I call real drive.
Available now at TalkStreamLive.com.
He became a millionaire by the age of 30, but ended up in bankruptcy, losing it all by the age of 40. The amazing story of one man driven to the brink of death after becoming the victim of an embezzlement scheme. After planning his own suicide, he turned to God and discovered a secret so powerful that it changed his life forever. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle is more than just one man's story of beating the odds and rebuilding his life after a total financial collapse. It's a book that reveals a life-changing prayer method that anyone can use to find hope during life's darkest financial trials. You will learn how to enlist God's help in solving your financial problems. The biggest prayer mistake most people make when approaching God with a financial need. How prayer can provide you with immediate answers and direction to your most pressing financial issues. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle, an Amazon.com bestseller from James L. Paris, the editor of ChristianMoney.com. How to Pray for a Financial Miracle, available in paperback or for Kindle from Amazon.com.
This is Jim Paris Live, your source for money and political conversation from a Christian perspective. And now your host, the author of more than 20 books, and the editor-in-chief of ChristianMoney.com, James L. Paris.
All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of the broadcast. We are live with you here on a Sunday night, doing this from my home near Daytona Beach, Florida. I always say near Daytona Beach, even though I actually live in Palm Coast, Florida, but nobody seems to know where Palm Coast is, so we say Daytona Beach is sort of a point of reference. But if you are familiar with the east coast of Florida, sort of central Florida and then the east coast, I am about halfway between Jacksonville and Daytona Beach, just to give you a point of reference, and I live about 5 minutes from the ocean, just on this side of the bridge on the mainland, just to sort of get that in your mind's eye. Anyway, good to have you with us tonight. My name is Jim Paris. I'm the editor-in-chief of the website ChristianMoney.com. We have a fantastic program lined up for you tonight, and I'm super excited. My guest in just a couple of minutes is the author of The Kickstarter Handbook, and his name is Don Steinberg. We're going to talk about this whole new revolution in what is called crowdfunding. You know, this is where you come up with an idea for a project that you want to do, whether it's recording an album or it's filming a movie or writing a book. I mean, it could be anything. Those are just a few examples. And you then use the internet, and people willingly give you their money to back your project. But there's all kinds of nuances to this. For example, the people that invest in your project, I use the word invest sort of in quotes there, because they're actually not investing in a traditional sense. They're backing your project, and by backing you, they're going to get some incentives, and those incentives are up to you. You know, for example, you might agree that everybody that pitches in $100 towards your project of producing a book gets their name listed in the book and maybe even a signed copy of the book. So we're going to get into all of the details of this tonight with my guest. His name is Don Steinberg, the name of the book, The Kickstarter Handbook. And I did buy it. I'm not finished reading it yet, but it's a great book because it gives you a really good overview of the whole process of Kickstarter. And then he actually goes into some real-life examples of people that have used Kickstarter to raise money for their various campaigns. All right. We've got to get into it tonight, right? The George Zimmerman case, and I'm not one to be drawn into these cases. I don't know how I get drawn into them, but I do. And I guess in this particular case, it hit really close to home. I myself am a neighborhood watch leader. I am the captain of the neighborhood watch in the community where I live. I'm also a concealed carry weapons holder, and I'm also somebody that calls in stuff all the time. you know, I don't know, once a month I'm calling in to the non-emergency line. So there's a lot of things there where I could identify with George Zimmerman, but I wasn't just going to give this guy, you know, sort of an automatic pass, and I wasn't going to just automatically believe his story. But I find this case so fascinating, even if we go all the way back, for example, to NBC News editing the 911 call to make George Zimmerman sound like he was a racist, to sort of the current narrative that we're hearing from the media about how this all broke down. My wife was sharing with me today, we have talked quite a bit about the case, and of course, if you don't know the news, you've been living under a rock. But the news is that George Zimmerman was found not guilty late last night. What was it, 10 or 11 o'clock last night? The jury came back in, and it was not guilty. And it's interesting because even people that you consider to be friends, like on your social media, there's lots of disagreement about the whole George Zimmerman case and, you know, was he really guilty or not? And I want you to just – I want to shed light on a couple of things that might help you to sort of be able to come to peace with the whole matter of the not guilty verdict. Number one is if you watched the trial – not everybody did – but if you actually watched the trial for yourself, there seems to be a lot of evidence to suggest that Trayvon Martin actually doubled back and actually ambushed George Zimmerman and attacked him. I mean, that's what the evidence would suggest if you watched the trial. Now, if you didn't watch the trial, you won't know that. But that's a substantial part of the case that the defense, you know, raised that issue, that it appears that Trayvon Martin doubled back. And there was a moment in the closing arguments where the defense attorney, Mark O'Meara, he actually ran a stopwatch where they were able to isolate 4 minutes of time where Trayvon Martin had 4 minutes of time to actually go back to his home, which I guess was no more than a few steps away. But in fact, after those 4 minutes, he comes back, and that's when the confrontation started. So that's one huge piece of this. So if you didn't watch the trial and you're hearing only what the media is telling you, which is that George Zimmerman got out of his car and chased down a young boy and shot him, if that's the only story you're hearing, I have no question at all why you probably feel like this was a miscarriage of justice. But look into that part of it, and that might help you to feel a little bit more at peace with this. The second thing is to really think about the beyond a reasonable doubt issue. You know, the fact is that that's a very high standard. And that's a really great part of our constitutional fabric, because we can't just grab someone off the street, accuse them of something, and then throw them in prison for the rest of their lives. We have to have a trial, and we have to prove that that person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So when you factor in those two things, it's really easy for me to come to peace with the not guilty verdict. To me, it started looking a lot like it was going to be a matter of self-defense. And I found it odd, though, that even a lot of the commentators on television and radio that conceded, even in hypothetical terms, that this might be self-defense, they still said, yeah, but he still should not have shot him. Even if it was that he was trapped to the ground, being, you know, beaten and his head being pounded on the cement, he still should not have shot him. And I don't understand that logic. I certainly understand those people that question the story, that say, was he really pinned to the ground like that? Did he really, you know, stay in his car and just get out to check an address, or was he pursuing him? I understand all of those questions. But again, when you get back to the issue of reasonable doubt, you know, was it proven by the prosecution beyond a reasonable doubt that George Zimmerman did what the media said he did, which is that he sort of just hunted down Trayvon Martin and shot him with no reason? That was not established at all. In fact, the case was very, very weak. And there's lots of talk now here in Florida about the political implications for our governor, Rick Scott, who appointed the special prosecutor, Angela Corey. There's a lot of discussion about disbarment for the prosecutors that were involved, and even a lot of comparisons historically to Mike Nifong, if you remember, the prosecutor in the Duke rape cases, where he was caught lying to the judge. He was caught manufacturing evidence, all kinds of horrible things. I don't know all the details on that. I'm just sort of paraphrasing what I remember from that. But he was disbarred, and I think he actually was criminally charged in that case. I don't remember. It was a few years back. But they're making a lot of comparisons to the Mike Nifong situation in North Carolina, the Duke lacrosse player's rape case. They're making that comparison to how the prosecutors acted in this case. So this show, we don't get into this kind of thing. It's not really our topic area, but we do talk about the news, and you'd have to be living under a rock to have not been hearing about the George Zimmerman case the last couple of days. I still scratch my head and ask myself, how in the world did this case get to be so huge? I mean, you look in the newspaper, and on any given weekend, there's 50 to 70 people shot in Chicago, and that's just one city. So how did we pick this one particular case and make this the official soap opera drama that we were all going to watch for 16 or 17 months? I don't know how that happens in our culture, but it did in this particular case. So we continue to watch. There's now news reports that the Justice Department has sort of a renewed interest in this whole matter. And a lot of people don't know this, but you can actually be tried by the federal government, even though you were already tried and found not guilty by the state government. I went to law school for 1 year, so I know just a little bit, enough to be dangerous. And you can be tried by what's called a different sovereign. And the federal government is a separate sovereign power from the state governments. So that means a state can try you for a crime and you could be found not guilty. And it is not double jeopardy then for the feds to drag you in and to prosecute you for maybe the exact same crime, but on a federal level. So in this case, it would be like a civil rights type of a prosecution, which is similar to what happened in the Rodney King case, where the police officers were originally found not guilty, but then they were later found guilty for civil rights violations. So as the world turns, the George Zimmerman case will continue to be on our radar screen here for some period of time. Again, my name is Jim Paris. I'm the editor-in-chief of the website ChristianMoney.com. We get together on Sunday nights. We talk about money. We talk about news. We talk about politics. And tonight, my guest, a fascinating guest, we're going to be talking with him in just a moment. The name of his book is The Kickstarter Handbook, Real Life Success Stories of Artists, Inventors, and Entrepreneurs. His name is Don Steinberg. Now, if you're listening right now and you have heard of the concept of crowdfunding, you're somebody that has an idea for a project of your own. Maybe you want to produce a movie. Maybe you want to write a book, record an album, go on a tour. You know, maybe you want to tour the United States and teach a class. I mean, you can do anything under the context of this sort of thing. It's called crowdfunding. And we're going to talk tonight specifically about Kickstarter. So we're going to also do this. We're going to be taking live phone calls as well. So if you would like to join us and bring up your own question on this, maybe you've done this and you want to share your success story. We are going to take calls for our guests. The number is 888-287-3316. Your questions on crowdfunding, or in particular on Kickstarter, which is only one of several websites now that you can use to raise money through so-called crowdfunding. Again, the call-in line is 888-287-3316. You can also send your questions in by email, jim@christianmoney.com, or I will be peeking over at my Twitter feed. My name on Twitter is @JamesLParis, @JamesLParis. Without any further delay, we welcome to the program for the first time. He is a business journalist and author of the Kickstarter Handbook. His name is Don Steinberg. Don, good to have you with us.
Hey, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Let me go ahead and crank up your audio just a little bit here, and then we'll get started. We'll get started with the interview. I'm sort of self-produced here. This is from a home studio, so there we go. A little bit better audio on you. Let's start with, for people that don't understand what this is all about, the idea of crowdfunding. funding. For those that have been living under a rock and have never heard of this before, give us sort of a quick introduction to the concept.
Well, the idea is that if you have an idea, there are these websites where you can sort of present the idea, you know, do a web page and maybe a video and explain what you're trying to do, and it's a way to actually collect pledges that go toward the project, whether you're trying to, as you said, maybe I'm trying to record some songs, or maybe I'm trying to make a film, or maybe I'm trying to bring a product that I've designed into the world. And so I can use this as it's sort of the power of the internet to connect to people that already know, and ideally people that you don't know yet who might be interested in helping you finance a project.
Now, one of the things that I am fascinated about this is why would someone give money to someone else over the internet to support their project? I understand with Kickstarter, you're not actually like getting part ownership. This is like if I said, hey, I want to start a business and I want you to put money in, but you don't get part ownership of the business. Why do people want to put money in and back these things? I can't understand it. I mean, it sounds wonderful. And then I go on there and I look. I was just looking a minute ago, and there's some little, I guess, computer code in there. When I went in there, it showed that right here where I live in near Flagler Beach, somebody just raised like $55,000 for a film they're doing. And I'm like, what? I mean, right here in this little town that I'm living in. So why do people want to put their money in to back these projects?
It's a good question, and it sounds kind of one of those too good to be true kind of things, right? It's true. It's not a loan. You don't get paid back, and you don't get equity. You don't get a stock in the company. I think people do it for different reasons, and it kind of depends on the project. If somebody was making a movie about, you know, something that I was always interested in, I thought someone should make a movie about that, and then some guy goes on and says, you know, I'd like to make a movie about, you know, Hot Wheels cars or whatever it might be, right? Some toy that I liked when I was a kid, who knows? And he needs $10,000. So, you know, and then he said, you know, if you pledge $25, I'll send you a DVD of the movie when it comes out, and I'll put your name in the credits, and I might pledge $25 to see that movie happen. You know, in other cases, people are inventing products, and you would get an early version of that product. A guy designed a guitar for children, you know, a really small guitar, and those people who pledge, you know, $120 or something would get a version of it that was probably cheaper than it would cost later in a store. So there's all different reasons people just like the power of the internet to kind of, you know, influence things directly, you know, connect with people. We all go on eBay and, you know, trade, you know, our junk for money and vice versa, and, you know, meet people. And I think people like the internet sort of cutting out the middleman a little bit.
And is this sort of like the idea that, hey, if we all just give a dollar to something, it's going to be millions of dollars will be there. So it's just kind of fun to watch that happen. It's like at our local mall, there's one of these big, I don't know what it's called, but you drop like a coin in it and it goes around in a circle. And you just sit there and you watch it and it goes around and then all of a sudden it disappears. And people will line up there to put their money in for no reason other than to just watch their money go around in a circle and take their money from them. And they just love the experience of seeing what happens when they drop that quarter in there. Is it sort of the whole game of it, like just watching this whole thing happen? Somebody has an idea, and all of a sudden people are giving money, and you feel like, well, maybe I should give money, and you sort of get swept up into that whole idea of just sort of playing the game.
I think that's a good point. I think there is a certain game aspect to it, and they all, you know, there's a word that they use called the gamification of things. Even you know, they make like ATMs and vending machines more fun, you know, I think there is an aspect, because the way that Kickstarter works, and they don't all work the same way, is you set a goal. You say, I need $5,000, and if you don't get to $5,000 within the number of days you choose, it might be 30 days usually, then you don't get any of the money. So there is a game aspect to will they make the goal and how close is it getting day by day? And I think people do get swept up in it. And I think people want to be sort of part of these, you know, communities.
And his name is Don Steinberg. The name of his book is The Kickstarter Handbook, and you can get it over at Amazon. It's available in paperback. You can also buy it on Kindle, and I bought it on Kindle about a month ago, and I'm almost done reading it. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about was one of the questions that I have, and I think a lot of people would have, is do you have to be a nonprofit to be able to have people give you their money? And if you're not a nonprofit, what is this money considered to be? Is this income that you have to list on your tax return? Or what do we actually classify these dollars as that flow into my bank account?
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to be a nonprofit, and which means that the money that you might pledge to Kickstarter is not necessarily tax deductible when you give money. You could become a nonprofit, or a nonprofit could post a project, and they would have their 501c3 status. And then it would be a tax deduction, and they would, you know, deal with the income that way. But yeah, I mean, if I'm on Kickstarter and I say I want to, make a mural on the wall in a public place, and people give me $2,000, that's income for me. So
I did a little bit of reading on this, and some people say, well, under the federal gift tax, actually the giver of a gift is the one that owes the tax, but in fact, if the amount of the gift is under a certain threshold, I think it's like $10,000 or something like that, that actually there is not a tax consequence. But this might be just so new that the IRS hasn't figured out a way to get their arms around it. Do you know if at the end of any of this people are being issued 1099s or anything from Kickstarter once they cut a check to them? I mean, for example, are you required to provide them with, like, your taxpayer ID number, and then you get some sort of a 1099 saying, hey, this is being reported over to the IRS, this money that we're forwarding over to you from your backers?
It's just a question. I know that when you in order to do it, you need to actually – Kickstarter kind of works through Amazon, as this payment service that Amazon has called Amazon Payments, and when you sign up for that – you really just give them your credit card information. So I think it is almost like freelance income that you might earn. You need to self-report that.
Right on your Schedule C or within your corporation. But
Right.
Yeah, that would be interesting to do some research into what the tax side of this is. Now, one of the things I found fascinating about this, Don, was the success rate is something like 44% on Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. That means that almost half of the people, and you've got to figure that, you know, I don't care what it is, half of the people don't succeed at anything. I mean, you could probably go into a Denny's and find that half the people couldn't order properly. I mean, the idea that half of the people that do this actually successfully raise all of the money that they're looking to raise is
right.
Unbelievable to me.
When you look at it that way, yeah. I think it takes you don't want to go into it kind of half-hearted and expecting it to be easy. So I think people have wised up to the fact that it requires some work. Basically, you know, I mean, even though the internet is magic, as we all know, it's asking people for money. So A, it's asking people you know, your friends, your family, and then asking people you don't know to give you money, and you'll give them something in return. But it's a leap of faith at the beginning, and so it's hard. It is surprising that many people succeed. But I think people are getting better at figuring out how much to ask for, and maybe and in some cases failing the first time and succeeding the second time.
I read two articles this afternoon preparing for the interview. One was about the Christian artist named Carmen. I don't know if you know who he is.
No.
Okay, his stage name is Carmen, C-A-R-M-A-N. And in February of this year, he was diagnosed with cancer. And he's a Christian singer, and then I think for a few years he was a Christian rapper. I think he's a man in his 50s now. Anyway, so he's diagnosed with cancer. God love the man. And he's, you know, facing this, you know, terminal cancer diagnosis. And he decides he wants to do a big musical tour despite having the cancer diagnosis. So he goes to Kickstarter. And according to the articles I read, the guy raises over $500,000, breaking some like record on Kickstarter. Then another Christian artist, and by the way, I'm saying this because our show is sort of marketed towards a Christian audience. We're produced by ChristianMoney.com. Okay. I know you're probably not all that familiar with me and my background, but another guy, a filmmaker out of the Chicago area, his name is Darren Wilson. He's producing a Christian film. I guess this is his second go-round. He goes to Kickstarter, raises $357,000. Now, this is just mind-boggling to me, yeah, the amount of money. Then I read another article today that Seth Godin, you know, the internet guy who's he's bald, yeah, and he wears the funny round glasses, he just, yeah, raised like $130,000 for his latest book. And I'm thinking to myself, aren't we in the middle of like the Great Recession and everybody is broke and everybody in the drive-thru in front of me is ordering from the dollar menu? Where in the world is all of this money coming from? Are these just unusual examples, or are people really raising these six-figure amounts on a regular basis?
You know, it's a big world, so I think they are, and I think that there are rich. I think there are people who are struggling, and there are people who have some extra money to throw away, and you're seeing both of it. But what those examples probably show is that people are tapping into the communities that they already have and that they've built. So, I mean, not necessarily people they know personally, but you know, Seth Godin has built this online following for at least a decade, and I'm sure the artists that you mentioned also can tap into their fans, the Christian community, and rally support that way. And so, I mean, what I wrote was that kind of the dirty secret to crowdfunding is that you kind of have to bring your own crowd to a certain extent, or find it.
So you've got to have a little bit of a following to be able to do this. And I was reading that the average campaign is something like about $8,000 to $10,000. So when we see in the news like these big numbers, it may give people the wrong idea. Is there any regulation, Don, of how the money is spent? And let me give you just a quick thumbnail on my background. I come from a Wall Street background. I put that in quotes. I never lived in New York, but I've been a stockbroker, financial advisor, money manager for most of my life until I stopped doing that about 4 or 5 years ago. And back in that world, when you raise money, you have to produce a prospectus. And you have to show people pretty much where every dollar and every nickel and dime and penny is going. And if you don't allocate that money as you promised, now you're all of a sudden guilty of securities fraud and you're sharing a cell with Bernard Madoff.
Right.
When you're raising money for something like this, being a cynic here, being a devil's advocate, what would stop somebody from saying, hey, I've got a great idea for whatever, and they go on the internet, raise a bunch of money, and then just use it for their own personal uses and don't ever really live up to what they said they were going to do with the money? Is there any way of these – are these people regulated or held accountable in any way?
You know, short answer is not really. The Kickstarter, it's a small company, and they have been pretty reluctant to go down that path. And there have been actually some regulations about now it's totally separate. Companies can sort of do direct stock offerings now to smaller investors, which was
Is that also through Kickstarter? You can do it that way too?
No, that's a totally separate thing. And I don't think there even are any companies taking advantage of the rule change yet. But it was part of the Jobs Act, I think. There was something in the
right, and isn't that where we split the word crowdfunding would apply to both, but one would be more like contribution crowdfunding versus like investment crowdfunding. Would that be fair?
Yeah, because really, you're not in a crowdfunding or Kickstarter kind of situation. You're not selling a piece of the company. You're not promising anybody any upside whatsoever. And although Kickstarter, you know, they kind of wash their hands of it, and they believe that people will do the right thing. I have noticed they've added some language. They've made it. If you're inventing a product, they require you to have a prototype ready, a working prototype to show. They make you list risk factors now. That's language that comes from the prospectus, right? So they're trying to protect their donors, they call them pledgers. But really, it's sort of a little bit of an act of faith that, you know, that
it's the Wild West.
Yeah.
It's just like the Wild West. Let's go to the phone lines now. If you have a question about crowdfunding, specifically about Kickstarter, this is your chance. I mean, if you've been thinking about doing this, we've got the guy with us here. He's the one that wrote the book, The Kickstarter Handbook, and his name is Don Steinberg, and you can talk to him live right now by dialing 888-287-3316. 888-287-3316. We go to the phone lines now, and our first caller from the St. Paul, Minneapolis area is Joanne. Joanne, say hello to Don Steinberg. Hello, Joanne. Are you with us? Let's see.
Can you hear me?
Okay, now we've got you. All right, Joanne, say hello to Don Steinberg tonight.
Hi, Don.
Hi, Joanne. How are you?
Good. I have a question for you.
Okay.
I have a friend who wants to write a book, but she, of course, has to work in order to, pay her bill. Mm-hmm. Can she, when she raises her money this way, I understand it helps pay for the, it can pay for the production costs and that kind of thing, but can it also go towards paying her money that she wouldn't, so she could, take a sabbatical or something from her work in order to work on a project? Would it pay for that as well?
I love this question because, Don, that's something that I wondered. Like this Darren Wilson, he's going to take like a year to film the movie. So I imagine he's somehow paying for his mortgage and his food and, his living expenses during all of that. Is that all okay to do with some of this money?
Yeah. I mean, look. If your friend or for instance, somebody like me who wrote this book, you get a certain amount of pay, and it'll take care of the time you put into it, right? So, the ideal situation would be to spell out, what you're going to use the funding for. People assume that if you're producing a book, that there aren't a lot of equipment you need to buy. The expense is your time and the time that you don't spend doing other things. So I think that's a pretty acceptable thing as long as it's not an extraordinary amount amount of money. Like I'm going to not work for a year and go to Hawaii and write the book.
Right, the total guide to thank you, Joanne, for your call. The total guide to using crowdfunding to live on the beach in Hawaii. I mean, that would be the book to write.
You
probably have a lot of interest in that. All right, we're going to put you on hold, Don. This is a 4-minute break, so you can stretch your legs and get a fresh cup of coffee or whatever you need to do, and we'll be back with you here in 4 minutes. And if you're fascinated with this topic tonight like me and you've got a question, you can join us. 888-287-3316. We have two lines available right now. 888-287-3316. We're talking about crowdfunding. The name of the book is The Kickstarter Handbook, Real Life Success Stories of Artists, Inventors, and Entrepreneurs. The author is Don Steinberg, and he's my guest tonight. We'll be taking more phone calls. You can also send your question over by email, jim@christianmoney.com, jim@christianmoney.com, or again, the toll-free number, 888-287-3316. We'll take a break. We'll be back in about 4 minutes. Stand by. Hello, everybody. This is Jim Paris, editor-in-chief of christianmoney.com. A couple of years ago, I was out in my neighborhood walking my dog, and I happened to notice an individual cleaning out a foreclosed home. And I do live on one of those streets where there have been a lot of foreclosures. In fact, at one point in time, there were actually five empty homes right on the street that I live in Palm Coast. So I struck up a conversation with this individual that was cleaning out this house, and he shared with me how much money that he was making simply cleaning out foreclosed homes and how busy he was. And it really got me thinking about how many people could benefit by getting this information. So I started doing some research to really ask the question, what would be involved in starting up a business like that, the business of cleaning out foreclosed homes? And I found an online course that I think is fantastic. I actually purchased it myself to check it out to make sure it was something that I could recommend. And it goes through the entire process of how to get started in a business like that, how much money you can charge, how to bid jobs, what licenses, if any, might be required in your area. And the author outlines the entire process, actually showing you how you can make between $500 and even $1,000 or more per day just cleaning out foreclosed homes. If you'd like to find out more about it, I want to recommend to you the website, foreclosurecleaning.us. That's foreclosurecleaning.us.
He became a millionaire by the age of 30, but ended up in bankruptcy, losing it all by the age of 40. The amazing story of one man driven to the brink of death after becoming the victim of an embezzlement scheme. After planning his own suicide, he turned to God and discovered a secret so powerful that it changed his life forever. How to pray for a financial miracle is more than just one man's story of beating the odds and rebuilding his life after a total financial collapse. It's a book that reveals a life-changing prayer method that anyone can use to find hope during life's darkest financial trials. You will learn how to enlist God's help in solving your financial problems, the biggest prayer mistake most people make when approaching God with a financial need, how prayer can provide you with immediate answers and direction to your most pressing financial issues, how to pray for a financial miracle, an Amazon.com bestseller from James L. Paris, the editor of ChristianMoney.com, how to pray for a financial miracle, available in paperback or for Kindle from Amazon.com. You're listening to Jim Paris Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Jim Paris, editor-in-chief of the website ChristianMoney.com. You know, about a year ago, I started getting concerned about the cost of our family's health insurance, literally costing us thousands and thousands of dollars each year, and the cost continued to go up and up and up. And I started doing some research into an alternative called Christian Medical Sharing. And I learned that through a special law, a special provision, Christians are able to opt out of Obamacare and actually get into this alternative to traditional health insurance called Christian Medical Sharing. I decided to go ahead and move into a plan like that, and I'm saving a lot of money. Now, if you'd like to find out more about it, get more of the details to find out if it's for you or not, I've written an article on it. In the article, I give you more details, including I actually mention the organization that I decided to go with. If you'd like to get all of the information on this and find out if it might be for you, check out this website, medicalsharing.christianmoney.com. That's medicalsharing.christianmoney.com. All right. Hello, everybody. We are back. My name is Jim Paris, and this is Jim Paris Live. We get together on Sunday nights, and we talk about money from a Christian perspective. And I've got an interesting week lined up here. This week, I'm going to be in Chicago, and it's a little bit of business, a little bit of pleasure. And next Saturday, July the 20th, I will be doing a four-hour workshop in Chicago, and it'll be on all of my money-saving strategies. We've never done this before, but we're doing a four-hour event, and it's going to be strictly about ways to save money. For example, we're going to be getting into how I get free home phone service for life, how I did that. We're going to talk about how you can opt out of Obamacare and instead use Christian Medical Sharing as your health insurance alternative. We're going to be talking about, A to Z, how to cut costs on insurance. We're going to be getting into different options that are now becoming available for cell phones, prepaid plans, instead of going with contracts. If you're looking to cut money out of your budget, you don't want to miss this live event next Saturday, July the 20th in Chicago. And this is sort of an interesting week for me because it's going to be partly vacation, and then we're doing the workshop. But then Saturday night is my third year high school reunion. So I'm going to be seeing a lot of family because, of course, everybody knows I'm from Chicago. So I'll be seeing a lot of family, a lot of friends, the high school reunion. I'll be going into the Moody Radio Complex on Wednesday, doing my Wednesday morning appearance with them live in the studio. And I'll also then be doing a television taping later that morning with Trinity Broadcasting Network there in the Chicago area. That show will be taped on Wednesday morning, and I'm told it will air on Friday morning sometime on, I believe it's channel 35 or 36. It's the Trinity Broadcasting Christian channel there in Chicago. And I'll be posting this all up on my Twitter feed, so you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/James L. Paris. My guest tonight is Don Steinberg. The name of his book is The Kickstarter Handbook, and you can get his book over at Amazon.com. It's available in paperback, or you can get it on Kindle, which means you can get it, order it on Kindle, which I love, and then you can start reading it like tonight, I mean right away. And what I love about his book is he actually gives you examples of people that have done this. And he actually followed some individuals that have done this and took you through the process of what they did. And that's an easier way for me to understand a concept like this, to be able to actually see examples in real life. So you want to grab a copy of the book. You'll find it over at Amazon. If you go to Amazon and you just type in the word Kickstarter, it'll come up as the first book. There's a lot of other things there, but it's going to be the first book that comes up. It's got a yellow cover. And again, you can get it in paperback if you want that, or you can grab it as a Kindle version as well. Don, the book is interesting for people that are thinking about getting involved with this. They want to do this. What would be a timeline for them as far as, okay, this is, what are we looking at here? We're in the middle of July right now, getting close to the third week of July. How quickly could someone do this? Do they need to be planning it for weeks or for months, or could they have a great idea and August 1st they're off to the races with the campaign that they post online?
You know, it depends. I think it could happen quickly. It depends. You know, if it's a passion project, you know, if that you've had for your life and you've always wanted to do a particular, you know, type of movie or product, you know, that's something that you've been thinking about for a long time, and you want to spend some time planning, what exactly you're going to do with it and how much money you need. I kind of recommend people spend a few weeks, just figuring out exactly what you're trying to do and what you need to do it. And sometimes, I've interviewed a lot of people in business, and sometimes money isn't the obstacle. When you know, I always wanted to do this great idea if I only had the money, and it's sort of an excuse. Money often is something, it's available to good ideas, people use it as an excuse to sort of not.
Right. I would write the book, or I would film the movie, or paint the mural, whatever, if I only had the money. And this is now a way to raise the money. We've got an email here. This is from somebody in the Chicago area, and I'm going to sort of paraphrase this. They're looking to use this to raise money to start a business. And my understanding is that's not something you can do. Can you help us to understand the difference between, let's say, raising the money for a particular finite project as opposed to raising money for a business, and why can't they raise money to start a business?
It's an interesting question, because people in effect are starting businesses, but it has to be based around one, as you said, a finite project. So say I have, these guys, and I hate to use the biggest, most successful examples because they're not the normal experience. But these guys raised like $8 million for the new video game system. You know, $8 million, because all the video game magazines and fans just wrote about it and blogged about it. And so everybody wanted to do it because, you know, they're tired of their PlayStations and Xboxes. So essentially a company like that, you know, I call it a company. It's their first product. They get $8 million. Now they have a company, you know, so now they can make other products. So there have been plenty of companies that have got started. But you really, you can't raise general funds. You can't get your seed financing, your angel financing, and say, well, we're just going to, we're just going to use this to build that.
So would the example be, Don, I could raise money to record a record, but I couldn't raise money to record, to like create my own recording company. But
right,
what you're saying is that if that first record produced a revenue now for me, now I have the seed capital because I have my first product and I have money coming in. So now I can start the business. And is there any limit on how many of these you can do? So I'm an artist, Don, and I record, let's say, one album. And everything goes great, and maybe like a 6 months or a year later, I want to go back to the source, if you will, go back to the well, and raise the money again to do my second album. Is there any limit to that?
There's not, and but except for the fact that you've gone through it once, and your fans that you built were happy with what you did and what you said you were going to do, and you did it, and they're ready to support you again. So in that way, you're not gonna be able to go back to that well if you didn't treat people well the first time.
Okay, so but there's no rule like Kickstarter's
right.
Not gonna say, hey, you just did an album 6 months ago, you have to wait another year or two before you can actually use us to raise more money again for something like that. There's no Kickstarter rule. Now, someone is sending another email we have coming in from the West Coast, and I'm just going to paraphrase this one again because it's pretty long. But what they're basically asking here in a nutshell is they're saying you go to Kickstarter, and I think this is a good idea, folks. If you want to learn about this, go to Kickstarter and look around because you can just see the actual – and what's neat about it is they've got some kind of program that knows where you are. So it'll actually show you on the homepage some things going on right in your own community, which is kind of cool because maybe you can actually go out and talk to somebody in your small town where you live that's actually raising money doing this. But this person's question is, how do you come up with the incentives? And this is interesting because if you look around on these projects, some people are really creative. Like somebody's raising money for a movie, and if you give 10 grand, you can be listed in the credits as like the executive producer, and you're even invited to like go to like the backstage opening night and meet all the actors that were in the movie if you give a large gift. But some of them you can even give like a dollar, and for a dollar you get maybe just like a personal thank you by email from, you know, the producer, which is really kind of nothing, but you're only giving a dollar. But then there are all these different, like, levels between that. Like, if you give $10 and $90, it almost seems like one of those telethons that you watch on TV where, you know, if you'll come in with, like, a $2,000 gift, you're going to get, like, this brass Elvis set of bookends that we're going to ship to you. This person's asking, how do you come up with like all those giving levels and the incentives? Is that just totally unique to each person's project, or is there anywhere you can go to like get some coaching on that?
The person who looked around at other projects for ideas is a great start, is a great idea. You know, to see what other people are giving, particularly, say, in what you want to do, if you are creating some sort of crafts, really fancy potholders or something, right? And they're artsy, you know, see what else is out there in that category that similar types of projects that people are, what kind of incentives they're called, rewards people are giving. In my book, you know, there are 13 categories, you know, film, games, dance, music, and for each of the categories I went through and I looked at dozens and dozens of projects and listed for each category, what were some of the more interesting and more typical, you know, low-end reward, sort of mid-range, and then sort of outlandish high-end reward. And what you get on the high-end, as you said, is the stuff you're not going to get on a pledge, which is a very personalized thing. I mean, there are musicians who make up a song about you. You know, you with your name in it.
Wow. Yeah, so your name will actually be in the song I'm going to write, you know, if you give a certain
right.
amount of money.
Or they'll come to your house and give a concert, you know, so.
I was listening to a podcast, and let me see if I can find it here on my screen real quick. I was listening to this earlier today. There's a guy who has an entire podcast over on iTunes, and the whole podcast is all about, it's called Funding the Dream. I don't know if you've heard of this, but it's like an entire podcast. The guy's name is Richard Bliss, and he's got like 146 episodes of his podcast. And his whole podcast every week is only about Kickstarter. And he has 146 episodes of this. And I was listening to a couple of episodes today, and I thought, is there that much to know about Kickstarter that you can actually record 146 episodes of a podcast on it? Is it really that complicated?
Well, I bet. I'm sure, you know, there have been about 100,000 projects on there, so he probably has different ones to talk about all the time, so maybe that's it.
Yeah, he does have a lot of, you know, he'll bring people on that have projects that are trying to raise money, some that actually did, and then they share their kind of their success stories. But Kickstarter isn't the only game in town, though. It's sort of like maybe the name we think of first when we think of the category, sort of like when we think about an online auction, we think of eBay. How many other sites are there like this, and would it behoove people, depending on what their project is, to maybe seek out other sites? For example, I saw just recently a new site called Faith Launcher, and it's a Christian site, so it's called Faith Launcher, and it's sort of focused on strictly Christian projects for crowdfunding. Is there a certain method to selecting which one you go with? Or your book is called Kickstarter, obviously, Kickstarter Handbook. Or should everybody just go with Kickstarter, or are any of these others worth taking a look at as well?
Yeah, there are alternatives. And, you know, I'm not connected with Kickstarter in any way. It just was the most, you know, widely used one to write about. But, yeah, you know, there are other general ones like Kickstarter where there are lots of categories and lots of kind of constituencies that are looking at the site. And there's one called Indiegogo, and there's one called Rocket Hub, and they're all similar. On Indiegogo, they don't have that sort of use it. I mean, they make it or lose it threshold. So if you ask for $5,000 and you only get $4,000, you get to keep the $4,000 on Indiegogo. So some people prefer that. Some people prefer the Kickstarter having a target, which sort of drives people higher in a way. But yeah, there are all kinds of, there are ones that are really more for charitable projects. There are ones that are more for.
Isn't there one that you have to be a nonprofit to do it? Isn't there one platform where they require that you're a nonprofit? But it is interesting what you just said, and we need to make sure people understand this. And you did mention it earlier that with Kickstarter, if you don't raise all of your goal, you get none of the money, or is it like if you only raise 80% of it, then you get to keep it? How does that work?
Yeah, it's all or nothing. You know, the idea is that the initial idea was, say I want to throw a concert, you know, and put on this big concert, and I need $10,000 to do it, and if I only got half that much, all the people who gave me money would still be expecting me to put on the concert, and I wouldn't have enough money to actually do it. So I would lose money on the event. So the idea is that here's how much money someone needs to physically, you know, execute this project. So whether it's a film or a painting, and then everybody giving money can be sure that. If that project is funded, if they're taking my money, it's going to happen because they have enough money to do it. So it's a way of sort of protecting the people who are.
Yeah, that makes sense because, you know, like you said, if it's going to take $5,000 to do the concert and you only raised $1,000, you can't do the concert really for the $1,000, but what happens to the $1,000 then? And then if you've already collected it from people and then you have all those like middle fees and everything to have to remit the money back. Let me ask you about the fees though. How much of my money do I give to Kickstarter? I mean, obviously they're not doing this for nothing. So if I raised like $10,000 to do something, how much of that do I really get and how much do they take?
Yeah. It's, they get, it's like 5%, and then because of the way the payment system works, basically people pledge with credit cards, so there's credit card fees that come out as 3 to 5%, and that's done through the Amazon payment system. So you end up, you actually, if you need $50,000, you're going to end up paying 8 to 10% in fees out of that, you know. Yeah, you're not really paying. I mean, it's kind of money you didn't have before.
Right, it's what you're going to net. So you should raise a little bit more than you need to kind of adjust for that. And then on this podcast I was listening to, they were making reference to like some third-party services that you can use to help you with your promotion, like where you can like track your statistics and stuff like that. Tell us about that.
Well, I'm sure that people have jumped into, as sort of consultants, but I found that the data that Kickstarter gives you about your own project is pretty good, you know, in terms of how much, how many people are clicking through and how many people are giving and how many people are giving at different levels and that sort of a trend line and how many days are left and how much per day you still need to raise. So, you know, there are lots of expenses that can be associated with a campaign, and so that's, you know, again, if you're raising, if you need $50,000 to make a movie, but then, you know, you're promising to send everybody a DVD of the movie when it's over, you know, there's that expense also for the shipping and the production. And
yeah, that's true. It's almost like you need to do like a financial budget. Is there any software or anything you can tap into to plan this all out?
Well, you know, in my book, I do have two different worksheets, which are spreadsheets, but it's not, can't like type into my book, actually. But you can replicate the spreadsheets that are there. And yeah, it does give examples of how you would sort of kind of cost out a Kickstarter campaign, so the idea is you don't want it to be successful and still lose money because you end up spending more to create your project and send out rewards to all your generous backers, and you end up having done your project but spending a lot more money than you thought you would.
And how's your book doing on Amazon? In our last minute here, we're going to give people information. It sounds like you're probably getting a lot of response for this book.
I think it's been doing really well. And, you know, people always ask me, did you do your book, you know, as a Kickstarter project and raise money to do it? And I didn't. I went to a traditional publisher. And, you know, the caveat when you do Kickstarter, and, you know, one of the caveats is that it's a lot harder than, it's not free money. It's real hard work. But the other thing is that you got to pay for everything. You know, if I made my book on Kickstarter, I would have to pay to print it and pay to ship it and pay to market it, whereas in this case I have a publisher that is doing a lot of that work for me and doing a good job at it. So,
and Don, thank you. Don, we are out of time, but you've been a great guest. It's a fantastic topic, and I highly, highly recommend the book. If you want to get a copy of the book, just run over there to Amazon.com tonight, type in Kickstarter, and then you'll see it'll come up number one. And Don, what we do is, this show is syndicated as a podcast, which also turned into a video that's put on several platforms. So you'll start to see a huge response within the next couple of weeks from our listeners who all listen in kind of different ways. But great guest, Don Steinberg, author of The Kickstarter Handbook. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And hey, if you're going to be in the Chicago area, come on out to my seminar next Saturday, July the 20th. I would love to meet you in person. And this is going to be a 4-hour seminar on saving money. If you've got some questions for me tonight about Kickstarter and you want to hit me with those, I'll be probably answering some emails for an hour or two before I go to bed tonight. Jim@ChristianMoney.com, Jim@ChristianMoney.com, or you can correspond with me on Twitter. On Twitter, I am @JamesLParis. This is Jim Paris, here as always to help you make the most of God's money. So long, everybody.
Been listening to Jim Paris Live. For more information about our program, visit ChristianMoney.com or send an email to Jim@ChristianMoney.com. Join us next week for another live program.